Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast, and we're going to do today again another one of our book discussions, and we're joined by Kevin Spinelli and Tim O'Brien, both Jesuit scholastics and interns here at America this summer. Welcome to you both.
Thanks
very much.
Now we're going to talk about a book that Kevin has brought to us by Peter DeVries, who was an author that is not that well known now, but was an editor at The New Yorker, very well respected at his time, sort of a writer's writer, it seems to me. And the book is called The Blood of the Lamb. Kevin, maybe you can just introduce how you came across this book, which published, I'll have to look here to see when it was published.
1961.
61. Okay, thank you, Kevin. And re-released by University of Chicago Press just in the last 5 or 6 years. But how did you discover it?
I took a class this spring at University of Chicago in the Div School, led by a medical school professor, a guy named Stephen Meredith, a scientist, who does a lot of courses on religious ethics. And the course that we took was a discussion of disease and God, God and evil. He called it God and Evil Part 57, because it's a question that haunts him. And he wanted particularly to look at novels, The Plague, Magic Mountain. This novel was part of the discussion, and he loved it. He brought it to our attention. I had never heard of either the author or the novel, and after reading it, I thought it was fantastic. Lots of dark comedy, lots of discussion of, you know, where is God in all this, and especially the reality of childhood disease, how it affects parents, how it affects us as believers.
Well, maybe we can start with the comedy. It transitions to more of a tragedy. But first of all, yeah, I mean, one of the things I definitely liked is that this is about a culture that I knew nothing about. You know, Chicago, Dutch Calvinists of a certain era, earlier in the century, a subculture that, as far as I can tell, has pretty much died out. Very unfamiliar territory, yet the questions it raises about faith, about grace, are ones that are you know, still of interest to our readers, I would think, and our listeners. So, Tim, maybe you can describe some of the comic elements of this book. The back of my book jacket describes it as a tragicomic Pilgrim's Progress. So it's definitely harkening back to kind of earlier works, but is doing it in its own unique way.
Sure. I mean, I think you have a definite mixture, or a case of what would be called the grotesque in this story. There's the balance between comedy and also tragedy, and sometimes the two are intimately intertwined in the book. The Wanderhopes, Don Wanderhope, who's the main character, comes from a family. His father is a trash hauler, and I think one of the funniest scenes is also one of the most tragic, which is where the trash truck that Don's father is driving winds up backing into the dump, and the two of them are tragically and comedically trying to escape from the dump to get themselves extricated from the trash being swallowed as if in quicksand. So you have this kind of family comedy that's going on here, as well as the more tragic elements. There's another scene where Don's father, who's an insomniac, is kind of teetering, about to fall asleep, sitting at the dinner table, when his head plops down in a bowl of chili. We get there's a long build up to that, but it's still a very, very funny scene, kind of even in the midst of the father's very tragic character in the book.
Well, he's also drunk, right?
Yes. Yes, he is. He was drinking liberally that night.
Yes, the Don character is definitely, you know, sort of a ladies' man, kind of ne'er-do-well, doesn't want to commit to marriage, for example, is trying to, you know, just go about his life without kind of any serious thought to you know, he kind of rejects his family, his the faith that comes to him from his family. And yet they seed early on the book, DeVries seeds the book with some of these questions that come to the forefront later about suffering, about faith. For example, the death of his brother, Louis. Kevin, that's one of the early instances where he's kind of struggling with the question of, you know, how could God let this happen?
Right from the beginning, the book opens with a scene. The family is together, and Don Wanderhope's father is a reverend in the Dutch Reformed Church, and he's going on and on in a discussion about God and Scripture, and the father is, you know, peppering him with questions. Well, how come Scripture is supposed to be infallible, and yet there's all these discrepancies in various stories, various parts? And the reverend is struggling to answer him, and toward the end of the first or second chapter, the Reverend goes off and is penning a sermon on evolution, or excuse me, on creation, sort of lamenting the whole discussion of evolution that's going on in the country in the early part of the 20th century. And at the end of the chapter, he puts down his script for the sermon and puts on top of it a paperweight, a rock that is, you know, something like 17 million years old. So there's a great juxtaposition between science and religion from the beginning, and it's rocked for Don Wanderhope at 12 years old by the death of his brother, who was an unbeliever, unrepentantly, you know, just thinking the whole notion of belief in God is absolutely foolish. We have traces of evolution and in our bodies from the start, from conception. So the death of Louis, Don Wanderhope's older brother, shakes faith out of Don at 12 years old.
Well, we should mention here that the names are very evocative in this book, leading, you know, principally Don Wanderhope, you know, kind of evoking sort of the journey he takes. One of the things we're going to do here is pick out a few passages, since the writing is quite evocative in itself. And Tim, maybe you can start with a piece you've picked out early on in the book.
Sure. It's right about the time in the novel where Don's brother Louis has become ill and is about to die. And that triggers all kinds of discussions of faith in the family, including a kind of forced deathbed conversion from his brother. And this is what the narrator, Don, has to say. "What people believe is a measure of what they suffer. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. There must be balm of some sort in that for men whose treasures have been confiscated. These displaced Dutch fisherfolk, these farmers peddling coal and ice in a strange land, must have had their reasons for worshiping a god scarcely distinguishable from the devil they feared. But the boy kneeling on the parlor floor was shut off from such speculatory solaces. All the theologies inherent in the minister's winding drone came down to this: believe in God and don't put anything past him. Or another thought formed itself in the language of the streets, in which the boy had learned crude justice and mercy. Why doesn't he pick on someone his own size?"
So why'd you pick that, Tim? What does it evoke for you?
Well, I think it bears on the question that surfaces later in the book as well as Don ages, of what the expectations of God are, or what our expectations might be of a being we call God. And the line that really jumped out off the page for me here is this: worshiping a God scarcely distinguishable from the devil they feared. And that's an image that comes up repeatedly throughout the book. Later, Don's wife will basically worship the same type of God. And he tries to be a voice of moderation, of non-judgmentalism, if you will, that is rejected by her and by her pastor. So there's all kinds of images of God that are in play here, these kind of negative expectations of God, of this being that is kind of haunts this book.
It's one of the things I like about this book is that it's dealing with kind of timeless questions about suffering. Why do people suffer? You know, why do innocents suffer? And yet it has a unique spin on them, just in his language and the way he phrases them. Your line, "the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away," reminded me of a later scene where somebody says that to him, and he says, "That's a heck of a way to run a railroad." And that's sort of like, it's a moment of comedy, but also, you know, of some real depth as well. Kevin, maybe we can switch to talk about one of the themes of this book, and you referenced it earlier, which is medicine and science, and how the scientific world interacts with the questions of faith and religion. Maybe you can draw that out a little for us.
It begins right at the start with a Dutch doctor who caters to the Dutch community there, named Birkenbosch, who's sort of a quack. His bread and butter is the superstitious Dutch community. That's where his income comes from. So he's very hopeful in science. He really doesn't know what he's doing most of the time. But he's a nice guy. People like him. And, you know, he's a successful doctor in the sense that he's not starving. We get doctors throughout the book. At one point, Don is sent to a TB hospital in Colorado. The doctor in charge of that hospital is sort of a bit more of a wise, urbane person. But still, again, not knowing anything really about TB as anyone else did, prescribing things like a pneumothorax and collapse the lungs and all these, you know, don't stay outside in the cold. Well, they're already in the mountain air, which is not good for TB patients. But all this stuff is found out later. And then with the sickness of Don Wanderhope's daughter toward the end of the novel, there's this whole notion of a disease invading the human being, and let's fire at it with all these weapons, get rid of this villain that's attacking this organism, this outside thing that's wreaking havoc and chaos on the system, causing suffering. And this Dr. Scoville, who is a professional in cancer treatment and developing drugs, and is really a charlatan himself, you know, always getting the parents, getting their hopes up in order that he might try his drugs on their children. And as Stein says, this quite cynical character toward the end of the book, these medications, this science, this medicine does nothing but prolong disease, prolong suffering. It does not ease it, and it does not end it.
Well, let's transition to kind of the latter half of the book. And as we referenced earlier, this book is both a tragedy and a comedy. And one of the things that struck me is that it makes that transition from comedy to tragedy pretty subtly. You know, when I finished the book, I said, when did this become a tragedy? Because in the book, the first half of the book, you're kind of laughing out loud. And then in the last half of the book, you're on the verge of tears. So I wonder, Tim, did that strike you as well? I mean, that this is kind of deft combination of the two.
Sure, absolutely. Even up to the point, after Don goes away to the TB clinic in Mountain Air, he comes back and meets a woman he was to marry, and eventually does marry. He proposes to her in a mental institution where she's a patient along with Don's father. So there, again, the comedy's still there. And a few pages later, his wife has first attempted to kill herself unsuccessfully and then succeeds. So very quickly, you're kind of plunged into, again, the sensation, as you are at the beginning of the book, of loss, of tragedy, kind of stalking this family. But it's very difficult to trace, I agree with you, that transition. It's almost like the transition of that Don makes between being kind of a man about town, making out with people in the parks in Chicago, to being a father and to the person we leave at the end of the book, which is a very serious, somber character.
Yes, I agree. That's another transformation that occurs. It's like, when did Don become a serious man? All right, I'm going to quote from one passage here, which is repeated twice in the book, so I guess that's a signal that we should pay attention to it. This is something that Don, I believe, submitted to his alumni journal of the school that he went to as kind of his life philosophy. I believe that man must learn to live without those consolations called religious, which his own intelligence must by now have told him belong to the childhood of the race. Philosophy can really give us nothing permanent to believe either. It is either too rich in answers, each canceling out the rest. The quest for meaning is foredoomed. Human life means nothing. But that is not to say that it is not worth living. What does a dubisse arabesque mean, or a rainbow, or a rose? A man delights in all of these, knowing himself to be no more, a wisp of music and a haze of dreams dissolving against the sun. Man has only his own two feet to stand on, his own human trinity to see him through, reason, courage, and grace. And the first plus the second equals the third. Okay, that last line is the one I'd like to focus on. Kevin, can you unpack that? I mean, I had some difficulty figuring out exactly what he meant by that.
I think he realizes throughout the novel that the third part of the Trinity, grace, is outside of a person. It's in with another person. I think there are at least two very important instances of grace in people that Don meets who make life worth living, and that's this Rena Baker, who he briefly meets and falls in love with, who dies at the TB hospital, and his daughter Carol. These folks are external sources of grace that make his life meaningful. These are not inside him. Another thing that I think about when I hear his philosophical statement, I think one of the things that makes Don a serious guy is, you know, there's that scene where he's out with his sort of ad executives out at a bar someplace in the city, and they're, you know, telling stories. When was the happiest time in your life? And trying to get a definition of what happiness is. And Don realizes what people say happiness is really the absence of pain. It's Epicurean. It's the restoration of the ordinary, the restoration of normal life once it's threatened. So this sort of throws him into the philosophical, especially with Carol's disease. All he hopes for is the restoration of a normal life where she can go to school, and in that is rapturous happiness.
Well, let's talk about that. The last, I would say, few chapters of the book, the last section where we're dealing with his daughter's illness. On one hand, I want to say it is not kind of mawkish or overly sentimental, even though this is territory that can easily become that. You know, when you're talking about a child who's sick, you're talking about children's hospitals, it's sensitive territory, difficult to pull that off. It's interesting at the end that he turns in a way towards Catholic imagery. You've got him at the hospital. He's stopping by this church every so often, St. Catherine's, I believe, and he comes across the saint of St. Jude, of course, the patron of lost causes. What did you make of that this Dutch Calvinist was suddenly kind of looking to Catholic imagery and tradition? Why did that become a stand-in for God in a way?
Sure. I think you mentioned the going into St. Catherine's Church and encountering St. Jude. That was a really important scene as I was reading the book, because it's the first time that in the latter half of the book where kind of reality seems to penetrate Don, where he just breaks down and begins to sob in the back of the floor of this church, encountered with the reality of a lost cause, which is what he's kind of trying to run from with the medicine and talking with his daughter's doctor. So it kind of is a moment of clarity, even though he then goes back into this hope that the medicine and will give him that one more school year. You know, she'll go back to school one more time, which is what he kind of keeps cycling back to, knowing, of course, that that may not happen, and indeed it does not.
Well, Kevin, you have a passage here from the near the end of the book that you wanted to share with us, so why don't you do that now?
Don, sitting beside his daughter Carol's bed in the hospital, she's all marked up. The treatments that she gets for leukemia go into her sternum, her breastplate. So she's got punctures all over the place. To him, he keeps thinking of the image of the stigmata. So there are two voices going on in Don's head as he sits looking at his child, who is noticeably in pain, suffering. The voices say, first, I ask my Lord permission to despair. On what grounds? The fairy is now a troll. The spine is gone. She supports herself on her breastbone. Do you do as well? Do you exist? If I say yes, it will only be a voice in your mind. Make me say it then, and be quiet. Are God and Herod then one? What do you mean? The slaughter of the innocents. Who creates a perfect blossom to crush it? Children dying in this building, mice in the next. It's all the same to him who marks the sparrow's fall. I forgive you. I cannot say the same. That's a pretty rough, despairing passage. And slaughter of the innocents is an image that comes up a few times toward the end of the book. He cannot understand how God can permit the suffering, the crushing suffering of a kid, an innocent kid, especially one who's so beautiful and dainty and smart and talented as his daughter Carol.
Well, maybe we can end by turning to a scene at the end that you brought up, Kevin, which is curious, to say the least. When Don finally has to deal with this fact that his daughter has passed on, he passes by this statue outside of St. Catherine's Church, and he had just bought a cake to celebrate what he had thought was going to be his daughter leaving the hospital. Maybe, Tim, you can describe what happens next.
Well, he actually, I think if my memory serves me, he's going into the hospital and he sets the cake down. He sees a nurse from the hospital and she says, you know, you might want to go over because there's an infection going around and everybody's in oxygen.
This is in the church. This is in St. Catherine's.
Right. He's in the back of the church. So he, in his haste, leaves the cake or the pie in the back of the church in a pew and goes over to the hospital where he's there for several hours for the death of his daughter. And he returns after you know, the paperwork and getting, as he puts it, very, very drunk in the nearby bar, at which point he takes the pie or the cake and throws it at the cross. And it kind of falls down to the ground. It's all over the statue. And earlier in the book, it's remarked, it's considered a remarkable statue because it's avoided by the pigeons, which seem to leave their tracings everywhere else but on the statue. Now it's covered in the pie that was brought for celebration.
There's also, when Carol has one really significant friend, a kid up the street named Omar, and they enjoy each other quite a lot just because Omar's a good kid, he's really sharp, and they just they click. They can be kids together. And one of the things they like to do is see vaudeville movies, and they, a couple times, they comment on the ritual that seems to happen in vaudeville with pie throwing. There's the expectant receiver of the pie in the face. The pie gets thrown at the face. The guy who gets hit with the pie takes his time, deliberately wipes receives the pie first, deliberately wipes the frosting and the pie out of his eyes, and then goes after a pie himself to respond in kind. I think what's so interesting about the scene at the end, you have a huge stone relief of the crucified Christ. Don, having gotten drunk down the street, only hours after his daughter has died, the love of his life. I mean, this guy has been just crushed by so many deaths and suffering. He goes back into the church to see if the cake was still there, comes back out, looks at Christ, gathers up all his strength, launches it, direct hit. Of course, Christ is nailed, but he pictures Christ sort of getting the frosting of the pie filling out of his eyes. And then he's got this great line at the end of the, he collapses basically on the front steps of this church. The author writes, "Thus wonder hope was found at that place where, for the diabolists of his literary youth, and for those with more modest spiritual histories too, was said to be the only alternative to the muzzle of a pistol, the foot of the cross." At the end of this book, Don can't leave that spot. God haunts him, suffering haunts him. He will continue to ask questions. He cannot be Stein. Another character in this book who is absolutely void of hope is riddled with cynicism and anger and bitterness. He still has an ounce of hope, and that's why he's at the foot of the cross at the end.
Yes, I thought that was very powerful too at the end. He cannot reject his faith entirely, he cannot embrace it entirely. So he's left at this point where all he can do is kind of throw himself kind of at the mercy of God at the foot of the cross. So a very powerful book, I would say the writing is in itself worth picking up this book for. And I thought it was very interesting how over the course of the book it kind of built up to where the end, the writing is so rich and so dense, and as you heard in some of the passages we read. But I want to thank both of you, Kevin, first of all, for bringing the book, and Tim for willing to join our discussion. And I hope we can do this again one of these days.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks. This book is a gem. Read it.
That'll be on the next book jacket.